I gathered myself to jump out of bed. I was expecting not to succeed. Well, in dreams, you often have no control over your own body, which seems paralyzed or somehow absent. I was rather counting on being woken up by the attempt, yet I didn't wake. I just sat up with my legs hanging to the floor. Nothing for it, I just have to dream this dream to the end, I thought to myself. But my good mood had vanished without a trace. I was afraid. "What is it you want?" I asked. My voice was hoarse, and I had to clear my throat. Unthinkingly, my bare feet sought my slippers, and before I remembered I didn't have any slippers here, I stubbed my toe so hard I winced. "All right, now it's going to come to an end," I thought gladly. But still, nothing happened. Hari had moved aside when I sat up. She leaned back against the bed rail. Her dress was trembling slightly just beneath the tip of her left breast to the rhythm of a beating heart. She gazed at me with tranquil interest. It occurred to me that the best thing would be to take a shower, but on second thought I realized a dream shower wouldn't wake me up. "Where did you come from?" I asked. She took hold of my hand and started tossing it up and down the way she used to, knocking my fingertips up and catching hold of them.
"I don't know," she said. "Is that bad?"
It was the same low voice and the same absent-minded tone. She always spoke as if she were paying little attention to the words she was uttering, as if she were already occupied with something else. Sometimes this made her seem giddy, sometimes shameless, because she would stare at everything with a muted astonishment expressed only in her eyes. "Has anyone seen you?"
"I don't know. I came here, that's all. Does it matter, Chris?"
She was still playing with my hand, but her face was no longer taking part in the game. She frowned.
"Hari?" "What is it, love?"
"How did you know where I was?" That made her think. When she smiled, her lips were so dark that when she ate sour cherries you couldn't tell, she showed the tips of her teeth.
"I've no idea. Isn't that funny? You were asleep when I came in, but I didn't wake you up. I tried not to, because you get grumpy. Grumpy and whiny," she said, bouncing my hand up energetically to the rhythm of her words.
"Were you down below?"
"Yes, I left. It's cold there."
She let go of my hand. Lying down, she tossed her head back so all her hair spilled to one side, and she glanced at me with a half-smile that only had stopped irritating me when I fell in love with her.
"But, Hari, but...
I stammered. I leaned towards her and raised the short sleeve of her dress. Just above the flower-shaped smallpox inoculation, there was a tiny red pinprick. Though I'd suspected this, I was still instinctively seeking scraps of logic among all the impossibilities. I suddenly felt faint. I placed my finger on the injection mark, which I'd dreamed of for years afterwards. I would wake up with a groan in crumpled bedding, always in the same position, folded almost in two, the way she had been lying when I found her almost completely cold, because in my dream I tried to do the same thing she had done, as if in this way I'd be seeking her forgiveness, or keeping her company in those last minutes, when she could already feel the effects of the injection and had begun to be afraid. After all, she was afraid even of an ordinary cut. She never could stand pain or the sight of blood, and then all at once she'd gone and done such a terrible thing, leaving five words on a note card addressed to me. I had it among my papers. I carried it with me at all times, faded and falling apart at the folds. I lacked the courage to part with it. 1,000 times I'd returned to the moment when she wrote it, and to what she must have been feeling then. I tried to convince myself she'd only meant to pretend to do it to scare me, and it was just that the dose had accidentally proved too big. Everyone tried to tell me that was how it had been, or that it had been a momentary decision brought on by sudden depression. But they didn't know what I had said to her 5 days earlier, or that I'd packed my things so as to hurt her as much as possible. and that as I was getting everything together, she had said entirely calmly,
"You do know what this means?"
And I'd pretended I didn't understand, though I understood perfectly well. It's just that I thought she was a coward, and I told her that as well. And now she was lying across my bed and gazing at me as if she didn't know I had killed her.
"Is that all you can manage?"
she asked. The room was red from the sun. The glow smoldered in her hair. She looked at her own arm. It had suddenly become important because I'd been staring at it, and when I lowered my hand, she placed a cool, soft cheek against it. "Hurry," I said hoarsely. "This can't be."
"Stop it."
Her eyes were closed. I could see them quivering under tightly shut eyelids. Her dark lashes touched her cheeks.
"Where are we, Hurry?"
"At home."
"Which is where?"
She opened one eye for a moment, then shut it again immediately. Her eyelashes tickled my hand.
"Chris!"
"What?"
"I feel good."
I sat over her without moving. I raised my head, and in the mirror over the wash basin, I saw part of the bunk, Hari's ruffled hair, and my bare knees. With my foot, I pulled up one of those half-melted tools lying around on the floor and picked it up with my free hand. Its tip was sharp. I held it against my skin right above the place where there was a pink semicircular symmetrical scar, and I pressed it into my body. The pain was acute. I watched the blood flow in large drops down the inside of my thigh and drip quietly onto the floor. It wasn't working. The terrible thoughts moving through my mind were growing more and more distinct. I'd stopped saying, "This is a dream." I'd long stopped believing it. Now I was thinking, "I have to protect myself." I glanced at her back, where it turned into the curve of her hips beneath the white fabric. Her bare feet dangled above the floor. I reached toward them, gently took hold of her pink heel, and moved my fingers across the sole. It was soft as the skin of a newborn baby. By now, I pretty much knew it wasn't Hari, and I was almost certain she herself didn't know it. The bare foot twisted in my hand, and Hari's dark lips filled with laughter without making a sound.
"Stop it,"
she whispered. I eased my hand away and stood up. I was still naked. As I dressed hurriedly, I saw her sit on the bunk. She was watching me. "Where are your things?" I asked, and regretted it immediately.
"My things?"
"You mean you only have that dress?" By this stage, I was just putting on an act. I deliberately tried to sound casual, ordinary, as if we'd just parted the day before, or rather, as if we'd never parted at all. She stood up, and with the light but firm gesture I knew so well, she brushed her dress to straighten it out. My words had intrigued her, though she didn't say anything. For the first time, she took a long, hard look at her surroundings. Then she looked back at me, visibly surprised.
"I don't know," she said helplessly. "Maybe in the locker?"
she added, and opened the door. "No, there's nothing but overalls in there," I replied. I found an electric razor by the wash basin and began shaving. As I did so, I tried not to stand with my back to the girl, whoever she was. She walked around the cabin, peering into every corner, looking out of the window. In the end, she came up to me and said,
"Chris, I have the feeling that something's happened."
She broke off. I waited, the turned-off razor in my hand.
"It's as if I'd forgotten something. As if I'd forgotten a great deal. I know I only remember you and nothing else."
I listened, trying to control the look on my face.
"Was I sick?"
"Well, you could put it like that. Yes, for a while you were a bit sick."
"Oh, well, then that's probably what it is."
She was already in better spirits.
I can't express what I was going through.
As she stood there, silently, walked around, sat, smiled, the feeling that this was Hari in front of me was stronger than my churning fear. Then at other moments, like the present one, it seemed as if this was a simplified version of Hari, reduced to a few distinctive expressions, gestures, movements. She came close, rested her fists on my chest, by my neck, and asked, "How are things between us? Good or bad?"
"They couldn't be better," I replied. She gave a half smile.
"When you say that, it usually means they're bad."
"Not at all, Hari, darling."
"I have to go now," I said hurriedly. "Wait for me here, okay? Or maybe..."
"Are you hungry?"
I asked, because I myself suddenly felt a growing hunger.
"Hungry? No."
She shook her head so hard it made her hair wave back and forth.
"Should I wait here for you? Will you be long?"
"An hour tops," I began, but she interrupted.
"I'll go with you."
"You can't go with me. I have work to get done."
"I'll go with you."
This was a completely different Hari. The old one didn't intrude, ever.
It isn't possible, kid."
She looked up at me, then all at once took me by the hand. I ran my fingers up her forearm. The upper arm was full and warm. I hadn't meant it, but it was almost a caress. My body was acknowledging her, wanting her, drawing me to her beyond reason, beyond argumentation and fear. Trying to remain calm, come what may, I repeated, "Hari, it isn't possible. You have to stay here."
"No."
How strange it sounded. "Why?"
I don't know.
She looked around and raised her eyes to me again.
"I can't,"
she said as quiet as could be.
"But why?"
"I don't know. I can't. I have the feeling that...
She was evidently searching for the answer inside herself, and when she found it, it was a discovery for her.
"I have the feeling that I always have to be able to see you."
Her matter-of-fact tone prevented the words from being an expression of emotion. This was something quite different. It suddenly altered the way I was holding her, though on the outside there was no change. I still had my arms around her. As I looked into her eyes, I began to push her arms backwards. This movement, not entirely decisive to begin with, was already leading somewhere. It had found its purpose. I cast around with my eyes for something to tie her up with. Her elbows twisted back, knocked lightly against each other, and at the same moment flexed with a strength that rendered my hold ineffective. I struggled for perhaps 1 second. Not even a wrestler would have been able to get free if he'd been bent over backwards, as Hari was, feet barely touching the floor. But she broke my grip, straightened up, and lowered her arms, while her face took no part in any of this, bearing nothing but a faint, uncertain smile. Her eyes observed me with the same calm interest as at the very beginning, when I woke up, as if she was unaware of my desperate exertions from a moment ago, brought on by an attack of anxiety. She'd become passive and seemed to be waiting for something, simultaneously indifferent, intent, and a little taken aback by it all. My arms dropped of their own accord. I left her in the middle of the room and went up to the shelf by the wash basin. I felt caught in an unimaginable trap, and I was looking for a way out, weighing ever more ruthless options. If someone had asked what was happening to me and what it all meant, I wouldn't have been able to respond with a single word. But I was already becoming aware that what was happening to all of us in the station constituted some kind of whole, as dire as it was incomprehensible. Yet this was not what I was thinking about at the present moment. Rather, I was looking for some sort of trick, a maneuver that would make it possible for me to escape. Without looking, I could feel Hari's gaze on me. In a locker over the shelf, there was a small first aid box. I flipped through its contents. I found a container of soluble sleeping tablets and put 4 of them, the maximum dose, in a glass. I didn't even particularly conceal what I was doing from her. I don't really know why. I didn't think about it. I added hot water, waited till the tablets had dissolved, and went up to Hari, who was still standing in the middle of the room.
"Are you angry?"
she asked in a low voice.
"No.
Here, drink this." I don't know why I'd assumed she would do what I said, but sure enough, she took the glass from me without a word and drank the whole thing in one gulp.
I set the empty glass aside on the table and sat down in the corner between the locker and the bookshelves. Hari slowly came up to me and sat down on the floor by the armchair, the way she often used to, folding her legs under her, and with an equally familiar gesture she tossed her hair back, though I no longer remotely believed it was her. Every time I recognized her in these small quirks, my throat tightened. It was beyond understanding, and it was terrible, and the most terrible thing about it was that I myself had to dissemble, pretending that I took her for Hari, though, after all, she took herself for Hari, too, and in her own reasoning she was not being deceitful. I don't know how I concluded that this was the case, but I was sure of it, insofar as anything could still be sure. I sat there, and the girl leaned back against my knees, her hair tickling my motionless hand. We were almost completely still. A couple of times I glanced at my watch. Half an hour had passed, and the sleeping tablets ought to have started working. Hari murmured something faintly. "What was that?" I asked, but she didn't reply. I took this as a sign she was growing sleepy, though, truth be told, deep down, I doubted whether the medication would be effective. Why? I don't know the answer to that question either, probably because my ruse had been only too simple. Her head, swathed in dark hair, gradually sank onto my lap. She was breathing regularly like a sleeping person. I leaned over to carry her across to the bunk. Suddenly, without opening her eyes, she took hold of my hair lightly and burst out in a strident laugh. I froze while she was in fits of laughter. Through eyes narrowed to slits, she studied me with a gaze that was at once naive and cunning. I sat unnaturally stiffly, dazed and helpless. Hari giggled one more time, pressed her face into my arm, and fell silent. "What are you laughing about?" I asked in a hollow voice. The same expression of slightly uneasy puzzlement appeared on her face. I knew she was trying to give a straight answer. She tapped her diminutive nose and finally said with a sigh, "I couldn't say myself." It sounded like genuine surprise. "I'm behaving like an idiot, aren't I?" she continued. "It's just kind of suddenly... Oh, but you're no one to talk. You're sitting there all sulky like... like a pelvis."
"Like who?"
I asked. I thought I'd misheard. "Pelvis, you know, the fat guy." The thing was, beyond the shadow of a doubt, Hari could not have known Pelvis, or heard about him from me, for the simple reason that he'd come back from his mission a good 3 years after she died. I'd never met him up till then, and I didn't know that when he presided over institute meetings he had the annoying habit of prolonging them into infinity. In fact, his name was Pele Villas, which had been shortened to Pelvis as a nickname, something I also didn't know till he returned. Hari leaned her elbows on my lap and looked into my face. I placed my hands on her shoulders and slid them towards her back till they almost met at the pulsing, bare base of her neck. The gesture could actually have been taken for a caress, and judging from her eyes, she hadn't understood it any other way. In reality, I was checking that her body felt like ordinary, soft human flesh, and that beneath her muscles there were bones and joints. As I gazed into her tranquil eyes, I had an awful urge to tighten my fingers abruptly. I was on the point of squeezing when I suddenly remembered Snout's bloodied hands, and I let go of her.
"What a strange look you have in your eyes," she said evenly.
My heart was pounding so hard I couldn't say a word. I closed my eyes for a moment. All at once, an entire course of action came to me, from beginning to end, with all the details. Without wasting a moment, I stood up from the armchair. "I have to go now, Hari," I said. "If you really want, you can come with me."
"All right,"
she jumped to her feet. "Why are you barefoot?" I asked, going up to the locker and picking out two pairs of colored overalls for myself and for her.
"I don't know. I must have kicked my shoes off somewhere,"
she said hesitantly. I let it slide. "You won't be able to put this on over your dress. You'll need to take it off."
"Overalls? What for?"
she asked. She immediately made to remove her dress, but something very odd came to light. It couldn't be taken off, because there was no fastening. The red buttons down the middle were only decoration. There was no zipper or any other kind of fastener. Hari gave an embarrassed smile. Acting as if it were the most natural thing in the world, I picked up a scalpel-like tool from the floor and cut the material in the middle of the neckline at the back. Now she could pull the dress over her head. The overalls were a little too big for her.
"Are we flying somewhere? But you're coming too?"
she asked as we were leaving the cabin, both in our overalls now. I merely nodded. I was terrified we'd meet Snout, but the corridor to the docking bay was deserted, and the door to the radio station, which we had to pass, was closed. A dead calm hung over the station. Hari watched as I brought a rocket from the middle cubicle on an electric cart and drove it onto a free track. I checked and turned the micro-reactor, the remote-controlled rudders, and the nozzles. Then, along with the takeoff carriage, I wheeled the missile onto the circular roller surface of the launch pad beneath the central funnel of the dome, having first removed the empty capsule that was there. The rocket was a small vessel that served as a shuttle between the station and the satellite. It was used to transport cargo, not people, barring exceptional circumstances, because it couldn't be opened from inside. This happened to suit my purpose and was a part of my plan. Of course, I had no intention of launching the rocket, but I did everything the way I would if I were preparing it for an actual takeoff. Hari, who had accompanied me so many times on my travels, was somewhat familiar with it all. Once again, I checked the air conditioning and the breathing apparatus inside and turned them both on. Then, when I fired up the main circuit and the control lights came on, I crawled out of the cramped interior and indicated it to Hari, who was standing by the access ladder. "Get in."
"What about you?"
"I'll follow you. I have to close the hatch behind us." I didn't think she could have seen through the deception ahead of time. When she climbed the ladder and entered the vessel, I immediately stuck my head through the hatch and asked if she'd been able to find a comfortable position. When I heard a muffled yes from the cramped space, I stepped back and slammed the trapdoor shut. With a flick of the hand, I snapped the bolts shut as far as they would go, and with a wrench I had ready, I started tightening the 5 reinforcing screws set into wells in the plating. The sharpened cigar of the rocket stood upright as if it were actually about to fly off into space. I knew nothing bad would happen to the woman locked inside. There was plenty of air, even some food, and besides, I had no intention of imprisoning her in there forever. I wanted at any price to buy myself a few hours of freedom so I could make plans for the less immediate future and get in touch with Snout now on an equal basis. As I was tightening the second-to-last screw, I felt a slight shake in the metal struts that held the rocket in place, suspended from projections on 3 sides, but I thought I must have set the steel mass a-tremble myself as I wielded the large wrench. Yet when I took a few steps away, I saw something I hope never to see again. The whole rocket was juddering from a series of blows coming from inside, but the strength of those blows, even if the slim, dark-haired girl inside the vessel had been replaced by a steel automat, it wouldn't have been able to make the entire 8 tons convulse in that way. The reflections of the docking bay lights flickered and flashed in the polished bodywork. In fact, I didn't hear any knocking. Inside the projectile, there was undisturbed quiet. But the broadly planted stays of the scaffolding in which the rocket was suspended lost their sharp outline, quivering like violin strings. The frequency of the vibrations was such that I worried about the integrity of the plating. With shaking hands, I finished securing the last screw, tossed the wrench aside, and jumped down off the ladder. As I stepped slowly backwards, I could see the bolts and the shock absorbers, designed only to withstand a constant pressure, bouncing in their mounts. I had the impression the plating of the hull was losing its uniform gleam. Like a madman, I rushed to the remote control console and with both hands pushed the lever that started up the reactor and the communication system. At that point, from the loudspeaker now connected to the rocket's interior, there came a half-whimper, half-whistle that was utterly unlike any human voice, despite which I could make out in it a repeated howl. "Chris! Chris! Chris!" Though actually, I didn't hear it clearly. My knuckles were cut and bleeding from the helter-skelter of trying to launch the rocket. A pale blue glow lit the walls. Dust clouds burst from the launch pad beneath the exhaust nozzles and turned into a pillar of toxic sparks. Then, a sustained roar drowned out all other sounds. The rocket rose up on 3 flames that instantly merged into a single column of fire and flew out through the open launch aperture, leaving trembling layers of heat behind. The aperture closed up immediately, and automatically activated compressors began flushing clean air into the bay, which was filled with swirling clouds of acrid smoke. I was completely oblivious to all this, my hands gripping the console, my face still smarting with living fire, my hair curled and scorched from the thermic blast. I was gasping for breath. The air was filled with the stench of burning and a smell of ionization, unmistakable as ozone. Though at the moment of liftoff, I'd closed my eyes instinctively, I'd still been struck by the exhaust flame. For a good while, I could see nothing but black, red, and gold rings. Gradually, they dissipated. The smoke, dust, and fog thinned, drawn into the perpetually moaning ventilation ducts. The first thing I saw was the greenish glow of the radar screen. I started maneuvering the directional reflector, looking for the rocket. When I found it, it was already above the atmosphere. I'd never in my life sent up a projectile in such a mad, blind fashion, with no idea what acceleration to give it or even where to send it. It occurred to me that the simplest thing would be to put it in orbit around Solaris, at an altitude of 600 miles or so, because then I could turn off the engines. If they were left on too long, I thought it might lead to a disaster that could have unpredictable consequences. I ascertained from the tables that a 600-mile orbit was stationary. It didn't guarantee anything, true, but it was the only solution I could see. I had switched the loudspeaker off right after takeoff, and I lacked the courage to turn it back on. I would have done virtually anything not to have to hear again that terrible voice, which carried no vestige of anything human. This much I could say. All appearances had been smashed, and from under the appearance of Hari's face, another, truer face had begun to show, compared to which the alternative of madness was truly becoming a liberation. It was 1 o'clock when I left the docking bay.
Chapter 6, The Minor Apocrypha. I had burns on my face and hands. I remember that when I'd been looking for sleeping pills for Hari, I'd have laughed now at my naivety if I only could. In the first aid kit, I'd noticed sunburn lotion, so I went back to my cabin. I opened the door, and in the red light of the dawn, I saw someone sitting in the armchair that Hari had been kneeling by earlier on. I was paralyzed with fear. I jerked back, instinctively, about to flee. It only lasted a split second. The person in the chair looked up. It was Snout. With his back to me and his legs crossed, he was still wearing the same linen pants with the reagent burns. He was looking through some papers. There was a whole pile of them on a small table. When he saw me, he put them all aside and stared at me for a moment despondently over his eyeglasses, which were perched on the tip of his nose. Without a word, I went up to the wash basin, took the semi-liquid lotion from the first aid kit, and began applying it to the worst places on my forehead and cheeks. Luckily, I wasn't too swollen, and my eyes were fine, thanks to the fact that I'd closed them tight. I took a sterile needle, punctured some of the bigger blisters on my temples and cheeks, and squeezed out the serous fluid. Then I placed 2 sheets of moistened gauze on my face. The whole time, Snout observed me closely. I paid him no heed. When I finally finished these operations, my face stung more and more, I sat in the other armchair. I first had to remove Hari's dress from it. It was a perfectly ordinary dress, aside from the matter of the missing fastener. Snout, his hands folded on his bony knees, was following my movements critically.
"How about a chat?" he said when I sat down.
I didn't answer. I pressed on the gauze, which had begun to slide down my cheek.
"So we had guests, did we?"
"Yes," I retorted dryly. I didn't have the slightest desire to play along with his tone.
"And we got rid of them? I must say you went about it very energetically."
He touched his forehead, which was still peeling. Fresh patches of new skin were beginning to appear. I stared at them, suddenly feeling a fool. Why hadn't I thought about Snout's and Sartorius's so-called sunburn till now? All this time I thought it was from the sun, but, of course, no one goes sunbathing on Solaris.
"Though it was a fairly modest beginning, right?"
he said, ignoring the sudden flash of understanding in my eyes.
Various narcotics, poisons, catch as catch can, eh?
What's your point? Now we can talk as equals. If you feel like acting the fool, you'd be better off leaving.
Sometimes a person can't help being a fool, he said.
He looked up at me through narrowed eyes.
You're not going to try and tell me you never used rope or hammer. You never threw an ink pot like Luther? No, how about that? He said with a grimace. You're quite the stand-up guy. Even the wash basin is undamaged. You didn't try to break any heads on it, nothing. You didn't smash the cabin up. Right away, you just opened the rocket, slammed it shut, wham-bam, thank you, ma'am, launched it into space, and that was that.
He glanced over at the clock.
In that case, we should have 2 hours. 3 even, he finished.
He stared at me, stared with a disagreeable smile till he went on.
So, you reckon I'm a swine?
A complete swine, I agreed forcefully.
Is that so? Would you have believed me if I told you? Would you have believed a single word of it?
I said nothing.
Gabarian was the first one it happened to, he continued, still with his fake smile. He locked himself in his cabin. He'd only talk through the door. And us? Can you guess what we figured?
I knew, but I preferred to remain silent.
Well, it's obvious. We thought he'd gone mad. He told us some of it through the door, but not everything. You can probably even guess why he wouldn't say who exactly was with him. You know full well. Sum cuique, to each his own. But he was a true scientist. He demanded that we give him a chance.
What chance?
I guess he was trying to classify it somehow, figure it out. He worked through the night. You know what he did? I think you do.
Those calculations, I said. In the drawer, at the radio station, that was him?
Yes, but at that point I knew nothing about it all.
How long did it go on?
The visit? A week, maybe. Talking through the door, all sorts of things went on. We thought he was having hallucinations, that he was under some kind of motor stimulus. I gave him scopolamine.
You gave it to him?
Well, yes. He accepted it, but not for himself. He was experimenting. That was how things went.
What about you two?
Us? On the third day, we decided to force our way into his cabin, to break down the door if we had to. We had noble intentions of treating him.
Oh, that explains it, I exclaimed inadvertently.
Right.
And there, in the locker.
Exactly, dear boy. Exactly. He didn't know that in the meantime, we'd had visitors too. We couldn't attend to him anymore. He didn't know. Now it's kind of routine.
He said it so faintly that I surmised the last word rather than actually hearing it. Wait a minute, I don't follow, I said. Surely you must have heard something. You said yourself that you listened in at the door. You must have heard two voices, so...
No, there was only his voice. And even if there had been other unidentifiable noises, you understand we'd have assumed it was all him.
Only him alone, but why?
I don't know. I admit I have a theory, but I'm in no hurry to share it, especially since it doesn't help any, even if it explains a few things. That's right. But you must have seen something yesterday already, or you'd have taken both of us for madmen.
I thought I'd gone mad myself.
Is that right? So you didn't see anyone?
I did.
Who?
His grimace was no longer a smirk. I gave him a long stare before I answered. The black woman. He didn't say anything, but the whole of his body, tense and leaning forward, relaxed imperceptibly. You might have warned me, I began, with less conviction now.
I did. But how? The only possible way. You have to understand. I didn't know who it would be. No one knows that. It can't be known.
Listen, Snout, I have some questions. You've known about it for some time. Will she... It... What'll happen to her?
Are you asking if she'll come back?
Right.
Yes and no. What does that mean?
She'll come back like at the beginning of the first visit. She won't know anything, or, to be precise, she'll act as if everything you did to get rid of her simply never took place. She won't be aggressive unless you create conditions in which she has to be.
What conditions?
It depends on the circumstances.
Snout!
What's the problem?
We can't afford the luxury of keeping secrets.
It's not a luxury, he interrupted dryly. Kelvin, I have the impression you still don't understand. Though, wait a moment. His eyes flashed. Can you tell me who was here?
I swallowed hard and lowered my head. I didn't want to look at him. I wished it were someone else, not him, but I had no choice. A strip of gauze came unstuck and fell into my arm. I shuddered at the wet touch. A woman that I trailed off. She killed herself. She injected herself. He waited.
She committed suicide?
He asked, seeing I wasn't saying anything. Yes.
And that's all?
I said nothing.
That can't be all.
I glanced up sharply. He wasn't looking at me. How do you know? He didn't answer. All right, I said. I licked my lips. We had a falling out. Well, not exactly. It was me who said something to her. You know, the way you do when you're angry. I packed my things and left. She'd given me to understand. She didn't say it outright, but when you've lived with someone for years, you don't need to. I was convinced it was just talk, that she'd be afraid to do it. And I told her that, too. The next day, I remembered I'd left the shots in a drawer. She knew they were there. I'd brought them home from the lab. I'd needed them. At the time, I told her what effect they have. I got scared. I was going to go get them, but then I realized it would look like I was taking her seriously, and I let it be. The day after that, I went all the same. It was nagging at me. When I got there, she was already dead.
Oh, you poor innocent boy.
I started in anger, but when I looked at him, I could see he wasn't making fun of me. I felt like I was looking at him for the first time. His face was ashen. Unutterable exhaustion lay in the deep folds of his cheeks. He looked like someone gravely ill. Why do you say that? I asked, strangely abashed.
Because the story's tragic.
No, no, he added hurriedly, seeing me stir. You still don't get it.
Of course you can experience that as profoundly as you want. You can even see yourself as a murderer, but it's not the worst thing in all this.
Is that so? I said sardonically.
I'm glad you don't believe me, really. What happened may have been terrible, but the most terrible thing is what didn't happen. Ever.
I don't follow, I said faintly. I truly didn't. He nodded.
A normal person, he said. What is a normal person? Someone who's never done anything heinous? Right, but has he never even thought about it? Or maybe never thought about it, but something inside him thought it. The idea popped into his head 10 or 30 years ago. Maybe he fought it off and forgot about it, and he wasn't afraid because he knew he'd never carry it out. Right, but now, imagine that suddenly, in broad daylight, among other people, he meets it embodied, chained to him, indestructible. What then? What do you have then?
I said nothing.
The station, he said quietly. Then you have Solaris Station.
But what could it actually be? I asked hesitantly. You're not a criminal, after all, nor Sartorius.
Come on, Kelvin. You're a psychologist, he interrupted me impatiently. Who hasn't had a dream like that, huh? An imagining. Think of the fetishist who's in love with, I don't know, some dirty underwear, who risks his skin to obtain by hook or by crook a disgusting scrap of cloth that he adores. That has to be amusing, right? He's disgusted by the object of his desire, and yet at the same time crazy about it, prepared to put his life in danger for it. His passion may equal Romeo's for Juliet. Such things happen, it's undeniable. But surely you understand there are also other things. Situations, the kind that no one has dared enact beyond their own thoughts. In a single moment of confusion, breakdown, madness, call it what you will, after which the word becomes flesh. That's all.
That's all, I repeated mindlessly in a hollow voice. My head was in a whirl.
But the station, what does the station have to do with it?
Surely you're kidding.
The word becomes flesh. That's all.
That's all, I repeated mindlessly in a hollow voice. My head was in a whirl.
But the station, what does the station have to do with it?
Surely you're kidding, he murmured. He peered at me.
This whole time I'm talking about Solaris, nothing but Solaris. It's not my fault if it's so drastically different from your expectations. Besides, you've already seen enough to at least hear me out. We head out into space, ready for anything, which is to say, for solitude, arduous work, self-sacrifice, and death. Out of modesty, we don't say it aloud, but from time to time, we think about how magnificent we are. In the meantime, we're not trying to conquer the universe. All we want is to expand Earth to its limits. Some planets are said to be as hot and dry as the Sahara, others as icy as the poles, or tropical as the Brazilian jungle. We're humanitarian and noble. We've no intention of subjugating other races. We only want to impart our values to them, and in return to appropriate their heritage. We see ourselves as knights of the Holy Contact. That's another falsity. We're not searching for anything except people. We don't need other worlds. We need mirrors. We don't know what to do with other worlds. One world is enough. Even there, we feel stifled. We desire to find our own idealized image. There's supposed to be globes, civilizations more perfect than ours. In other worlds, we expect to find the image of our own primitive past. Yet on the other side, there's something we refuse to accept, that we fend off. Though after all, from Earth, we didn't bring merely a distillation of virtues, the heroic figure of humankind. We came here as we truly are. And when the other side shows us that truth, the part of it we pass over in silence, we're unable to come to terms with it.
Then what is it? I asked, having heard him out patiently.
It's what we wanted. Contact with another civilization. We have it, this contact. Our own monstrous ugliness. Our own buffoonery and shame, magnified as if it was under a microscope.
Rage shook in his voice.
So you think it's the ocean? What for, though? Never mind how for a moment. For the love of God, what for? Do you really think it's trying to play with us? Or punish us? That would be some truly primitive demonology. A planet taken over by a huge devil who satisfies his satanic sense of humor by sending succubi to members of a scientific expedition? Surely you don't believe in such utter nonsense.
This devil's far from stupid, he muttered through his teeth. I looked at him in surprise. It crossed my mind that, after all, he could have had a nervous breakdown, even if what had happened on the station couldn't be explained by madness. Reactive psychosis. I wondered further when he began to laugh very quietly, hardly making any sound.
You're diagnosing me. Wait a while yet. You've actually only experienced it in such a mild form, you still don't know anything.
I get it. The devil took pity on me, I retorted. The conversation was beginning to tire me.
What is it you're really after? You want me to tell you what plans are being hatched against us by X billion cells of metamorphic plasma? Maybe none at all.
What do you mean, none? I asked, taken aback. Snout was still smiling.
You know as well as I do that science is only concerned with how something happens, not why it happens. How, then? Well, began about 8 or 9 days after the X-ray experiment. Maybe the ocean was responding to the radiation with another kind of radiation. Maybe it was using it to probe our brains and get them to release some kind of mental insistments.
Insistments? This was beginning to interest me.
Right. Processes separated from the rest of the mind, enclosed, suppressed, walled in, sore spots of memory. It was treating them as a recipe, as a plan for reconstruction. I mean, you know the close resemblance between asymmetrical crystals of chromosomes and the nucleic compounds of cerebrosides that constitute the substrate of memory processes. After all, hereditary plasma is plasma that remembers. So it took it from us, made a note of it, and next, well, you know what came next. Why was it done? In any case, it wasn't to destroy us. That would have been a lot easier to accomplish. With its technological abilities, it could do anything at all. For example, confront us with our own doppelgangers.
Oh, I exclaimed. So that's why you were so scared the first evening when I arrived.
Yes. Though, he added, it may in fact have done so. How do you know I'm the same good old rat who came here 2 years ago?
He started laughing softly, as if my bewilderment gave him God knows what kind of satisfaction. But he soon stopped.
No, no, he murmured. There's enough going on without that. There may be other differences, but I only know one. You and I can be killed.
And they can't?
I'd advise you not to try. It's a terrible thing to behold.
Not with anything?
I don't know. In any case, not with poison, knife, rope.
Atomic blaster?
Would you be prepared to try?
I'm not sure. If you know they're not human.
The thing is, they are, in a certain sense. Subjectively, they're human. They have no awareness of their origins, you must have noticed.
Right. So then, how is it?
They regenerate amazingly quickly. Impossibly quickly, before your eyes, I'm telling you. Then they start all over again, behaving
Like what?
Like our imaginations of them. The mental record that was used to...
That's right, it's true, I agreed. I was ignoring the fact that lotion was dripping from my cheeks onto my arms. Did Gabarian know? I asked abruptly. He gave me an intent look.
Did he know what we know?
Yes.
Almost certainly.
How do you know? Did he tell you?
No, but I found a book in his cabin.
The Minor Apocrypha, I exclaimed, jumping up.
Right. How could you know about it?
He asked, suddenly worried, his eyes boring into me. I shook my head. Take it easy, I said. Come on, you can see I'm burned and not regenerating at all, right? In his cabin there was a letter to me.
Is that so? A letter? What did it say?
Not a lot. It was actually more of a note than a letter. It was bibliographic references to the appendix of the Yearbook of Soloristics and to this Minor Apocrypha. What is it?
It's an old thing. It might have something to do with all this. Here.
From his pocket, he took a slim little leather-bound volume with tattered corners and handed it to me. And Sartorius? I asked as I put the book away.
What about Sartorius? In a situation like this, everyone acts whatever way they can. He's trying to be normal. With him, that means being official.
Come off it.
Seriously. One time I was in a situation with him, never mind the details. Suffice it to say, we only had 1,100 pounds of oxygen left for 8 people. One after another, we gave up our daily tasks. By the end, everyone was walking around with a beard. He was the only one who shaved, polished his shoes. That's the kind of guy he is. Of course, whatever he does now is going to be play-acting, comedy or crime.
Crime?
Well, maybe not crime. We need a new term for it, like jet-propelled divorce. Does that sound better?
You're quite the wit, I said.
Would you rather I was crying? You suggest something.
Give me a break.
No, I mean it. Now you know more or less as much as me. Do you have a plan?
I like that. I don't even know what I'm going to do when she appears again. She has to appear again, right?
Probably.
How do they actually get in? I mean, the station is hermetically sealed. Maybe through the plating?
He shook his head.
The plating's in good shape. I've no idea how they do it. The guests are usually there when you wake up. And everyone has to sleep from time to time, after all.
What about locking them up?
It helps for a short time. Then there are other methods. You know what I'm talking about.
He stood up. I followed suit. Listen, Snout. You think the station should be closed down, but you want the idea to come from me?
He shook his head.
It's not that simple. Naturally, we could escape, if only to the satelloid, and send an SOS from there. Obviously, they'd treat us like lunatics. There'd be a sanatorium on Earth until we obligingly retract the whole thing. After all, there have been cases of group madness at isolated outposts like this. Wouldn't be so bad. You know, nice garden, peace and quiet, white rooms, walks with the orderlies.
He was completely serious, his hands in his pockets, staring vacantly into the corner of the room. The red sun had already dropped below the horizon, and the curling waves had melted into an inky wasteland. The sky was afire. Clouds with lilac-tinted edges drifted over the unutterably dismal, two-toned landscape. So do you want to run away? Or not? Or not just yet? He smiled.
You undaunted conqueror. You haven't had a real taste of it yet, or you wouldn't keep insisting like that. It's not a matter of what I want, but of what's possible.
What is?
That's what I don't know.
So we stay here? You reckon a means will be found?
He looked at me, scrawny, the skin on his wrinkled face peeling.
Who knows? Maybe it'll be worth it, he said finally. We're unlikely to learn anything about it. But maybe about ourselves?
He turned, picked up his papers, and left. I wanted to stop him, but my open mouth made no sound. There was nothing to be done. I could only wait. I went up to the window and looked out at the blood-black ocean without really seeing it. It occurred to me that I could lock myself in one of the rockets at the docking bay, but I didn't take the idea seriously. It was too silly. Sooner or later I'd have to come out. I sat down by the window and took out the book Snout had given me. There was still enough light. It turned the pages pink, while the whole room glowed red. The book contained a number of articles and studies, mostly of very dubious value, collected by one Otto Revincer, M.Phil. Every science comes with its own pseudoscience, a bizarre distortion that comes from a certain kind of mind. Astronomy has its caricaturist in astrology. Chemistry used to have alchemy. So little wonder that the emergence of solaristics was accompanied by a veritable explosion of the oddest notions. Revincer's book was filled with this sort of mental matter, prefaced, to be fair, by an introduction in which the editor distanced himself from this house of wonders. He simply believed, not without reason, that such a collection might constitute a record of the times that would be of value both to historians and to psychologists of science. Burton's report occupied a prominent place in the book. It consisted of several parts. The first was a transcription of his extremely laconic logbook. From 1400 to 1640 ship's time, the notes were terse and negative. Altitude 3,000 feet, or 4,000, or 2,500, nothing observed, ocean deserted. This was repeated several times. Then at 1640, red mist rising, visibility 700 yards, ocean deserted. 1700, fog thickening, silence, visibility 400 yards with clearer moments, descending to 700 feet. 1720, in fog, altitude 700, visibility 20 to 40 yards, silence, climbing to 1300. 1745, altitude 1600, banks of fog to the horizon. In the fog, funnel-shaped openings through which ocean can be seen.
something happening inside them, attempting to enter one such funnel. 1752. Kind of whirlpool visible, throwing up yellow foam. I'm surrounded by wall of fog. Altitude 300, descending to 60. This was the end of the transcription from Burton's logbook. The next part of the so-called report was an excerpt from his medical history. To be precise, it was the text of a statement dictated by Burton and interspersed with questions from members of the commission. Burton. When I dropped to 100 feet, maintaining altitude became difficult, because in the circular space, free of fog, there were gusty winds. I had to keep a firm hold on the rudder, and for this reason, for some time, perhaps 10 or 15 minutes, I didn't look out of the cockpit. As a result, I unintentionally entered into the fog, blown there by a strong gust. It wasn't ordinary fog, but a kind of suspension, colloidal in nature, it seemed, because it clouded all my windows. I had a lot of trouble cleaning them. The suspension was extremely sticky. At the same time, my rotor speed had been reduced by 30-some percent because of resistance from the fog or whatever it was, and I began to lose altitude. I was very low, and I was worried I'd flip over on the waves, so I gave it full power. The craft maintained altitude, but didn't rise any higher. I still had 4 cartridges of rocket boosters. I chose not to use them, thinking the situation could get worse, and then I'd need them. At maximum revs, the craft began to vibrate badly. I figured the rotors must have gotten covered in the strange suspension, but the load indicators were still showing zero, so there was nothing I could do. I hadn't seen the sun from the moment I entered the cloud, though the fog was a phosphorescent red in that direction. I was still circling in the hope that I'd eventually come upon one of those holes in the fog. And in fact I did, about 30 minutes later. I climbed into a free zone that was almost perfectly circular, with a diameter of several hundred yards. It was bounded by fog that was swirling dramatically, as if it were being lifted by powerful convection currents. For this reason, I attempted to remain as best I could in the center of the hole. That was where the air was calmest. At that time, I noticed a change in the surface of the ocean. The waves had almost completely disappeared, and the top of the fluid, the stuff the ocean is made of, had become semi-transparent, with smoky spots that faded away until, after a very short time, the whole thing was completely clear, and I could see several yards, I believe, into the depths. Deep down, there was a kind of gold-colored ooze that was gathering and sending thin streaks upwards. When it emerged onto the surface, it became glassy and shining. It started seething and foaming and solidifying. At this point, it looked like dense, burned caramel. This ooze, or sludge, collected into thick knots, rose up out of the ocean. It formed cauliflower-like swellings and slowly made various shapes. I started being pulled towards the wall of fog, so for a few minutes I had to counter the drift with the engine and the rudder. When I was able to look out again, down below, underneath me, I saw something that resembled a garden. That's right, a garden. I saw dwarf trees and hedges, paths. None of it real. It was all made of the same substance, which by now had completely hardened like yellowish plaster. That was how it appeared. The surface glistened brightly. I descended as low as I could to get a closer look. Question. Did the trees and other plants you saw have leaves? Burton. No. It was just a general shape, like a model of a garden.
Yes, that's it. A model.
That was what it looked like. A model, but a life-sized one, I guess. After a while, it all began to crack and break apart. Through gaps that were completely black, a dense sludge rose to the surface in waves and congealed. Part trickled down, part remained, and the whole thing began swirling and getting covered in foam, so that now I couldn't see anything else but it. At the same time, the fog began to draw in around me on every side, so I cranked it up and ascended to 1,000 feet.